Good evening and welcome once again. This is Big Al, and this is Big Al's Community Chat, and I'm with you tonight with the next hour of community information. You're going to hear some really interesting things tonight. It's me, myself, and I, and I guess that's two guests and myself. So here I am, and if you want to make a call and talk about something, 217-359-5483. And we'll see about discussing anything you'd like. But we're going to be talking about a few things today that has taken place here locally. Stan did a phenomenal job of talking about what's going on nationally, and I can only tell you I agree with him 100%. We're in trouble if Donald Trump takes the reins of our armies, Air Force, Marines, and Navy, and our nuclear codes. That's going to be a disaster waiting to happen, and I don't want to see my grandkids in that, or my children in that situation. So let's move on here. This is WEFT 90.1 FM here in Champaign, Urbana, and we're streaming live at weft.org. And if you happen to want to call in, 217-359-5483. And our first community information took place here in the last couple of days. Now, I was out of town when this happened, but we saw it in L.A. It came up on CNN, on other national news organizations. We were pretty shocked that something would happen in Champaign that would make the national news, but it certainly did. And the campus town shooting, world is a crazy place. This came out of the News Gazette, of course, and what happened here recently. If you're not sure, I'm going to go over a few things with you about it. Alina Hillel, Center for Jewish Life, a circle of communication, was put into place a few years ago for community members to be able to easily contact one another if danger struck a country where a student happened to be studying. We used it last year for the terrorist attacks in France and Belgium, Executive Director Eretz Cohen has said Monday. He never thought we'd have to use it here on campus. But in the early morning hours of Sunday, Cohen and his students who make up the Illini Hillel were in constant communication in their circles, accounting for everyone in the wake of shootings in campus town. Champaign police offered no new details Monday, which we will have an update for you here in a few moments. This comes from the 727 campus town News Gazette. Champaign police offered no new details on Monday about the investigation into separate shootings in the 300 block of East Green, the 700 block of South Sage Street, in which five people were struck, including 22-year-old George Korchev of Mundelein, a real tragedy of a gentleman who was just visiting Champaign, an innocent bystander who died from his injuries. That is certainly a tragedy. Any shooting is a tragedy, but here's a gentleman, 22 years old, a registered nurse, starting a job the next day and up in Mundelein, and he's gone. Of the four survivors, two were members of the Illini Hillel. None of the other victims had any affiliation with the U of I, campus spokesman Robert Kaler said. Eric Lazine, a graduate student, said Robbie Shepard, a research assistant at the U of I, were both shot on Green Street. Each had been released from the hospital, with Lassane even making a visit to the Hillel to take part in Sunday's weekly bagel brunch. We're very happy that Eric was in good enough condition yesterday to show up to one of our programs, Cohen said. It really made a big difference to see that he was okay and well enough to join us. Cohen said he spoke with Shepard on Monday morning. He's back home. He's able to move around a little bit. The other students are taking great comfort knowing the students are doing a little bit better. Just as an offshoot, yeah, understand that when the shooting of five people, four or more, that's considered a national tragedy, and it puts itself in with those other tragedies that we've seen around the country. This wouldn't be considered a terrorist attack, but anyone who can shoot more than four or five people, it becomes a national tragedy. With the Illini Student Senate organized vigil set for 7 p.m., this was the other last night, Campus Town was reeling Monday from the weekend incidents. Joe Spencer, the starting center on Levy Smith's football team, was in bed early Sunday morning at his off-campus residence when the phone buzzed with messages, all from the U of I emergency alert. For a place that I call home, it's hard to imagine that happening, said Spencer, an Ohio native. It's been tough for campus. But I think the administration and the chancellor has done a good job reaching out. Smith said Monday afternoon news conference that he hadn't yet spoken to the team about the shootings but planned to. With no game last Saturday, two Illini captains spent the weekend out of town, couldn't believe what they returned to later Sunday. Police say in an argument in an apartment, the 300 block of East Green spilled outside into a fight that resulted in shots being fired. The four victims on Green Street shooting were innocent bystanders. It's just incredible. It's scary because you could be out having a good time with friends, quarterback Wes Lunsen, and your life could change forever, as it did for this gentleman. The world is a crazy place, said Harney Nickerson. Well, if we move on, we're going to talk a little bit about this alert system that they have here on Campus Town for emergencies, and something you may want to also understand and learn about, because the U of I's role wasn't the first U of I chancellor Robert Jones was expecting on his first night in town. A middle-of-the-night text from one of his staff members alerted Jones, who said he had far too much experience with these kinds of tragedies, notably a fire at the University of Minnesota that claimed the lives of three students while he was in charge of student affairs. Another student visiting Minnesota died after falling out of a bunk bed, he said, but at this time I've actually had to deal with a shooting, first time. Settling into his office amid boxes yet to be unpacked Monday morning, Jones said he wanted to make sure students and the entire community was kept informed with accurate information to remind them that help was available. These things, even in general, a student body may not know the victims. It touches the community in a very profound way, he said. It's part of our responsibility to make sure that every member of this community is safe and that we make them aware of resources and the kind of things that happen when we reach out and let them know we care and remind them what they need to do to take care of themselves. Jones took part in calls with local police, and the police sent out messages to students on campus, which you're going to discuss in just a few minutes here. Jones took part in the calls with the local police and on Sunday before his first official day on the job. He said the incident was a reflection of contemporary issues that can be brought to bear in almost any community. Well, let's move on to exact Illini Alert's main goals. When shots rang out in Campus Town early Sunday, a series of emergency messages were relayed to 65,000 students, employees, parents, and others signed up for the Illini Alerts. The emergency notification system, mandated by the Federal Cleric Act, sends email and text messages in the event of a campus emergency. They also post on Facebook and Twitter at Illini Alert. So if you don't have that or sign up for that, you should sign up for that. The first message went out 12 minutes after police took the call at 12:50 a.m., and three others followed, the last at 6:46 a.m., giving the all clear. Most people received them within 3 minutes, according to U of I police spokesman Patrick Wade. While the alerts mentioned the shooting and shots fired, none was specifically that people had been injured or killed, which I think is obvious to all that that shouldn't happen. So here are some of what the messages look like or sound like if you're reading your phone. At 12:50 a.m., this is what you're going to see on your on this alert. There have been shots fired between 3rd Street and 4th Street on Green Street in Champaign. Avoid area. More information to come. At 1:22 a.m., it appears that the shooter has left the area. Continue to avoid Green Street from 2nd to 4th and 2nd Street from Green to Healy. 4:01 a.m., the suspect is out of the campus district. Police are investigating the incident. Avoid Green Street between 2nd and 4th Street. And 6:45 a.m., the emergency has ended. Check your email for more information. Police have a series of templates they can quickly modify and send a word to get out fast, Wade said. In this case, they use the template for the active shooter, but there are others for fires, bomb threats, tornado warnings, and the release of hazardous materials. It usually just comes out of the void, out to avoid the area, Wade said. These things obviously happen very quickly, and police often don't know how serious the situation is right away. It does the same with hazardous materials, which can be anything from a false alarm to a chemical cloud hanging over campus. So we send out the alert. Please avoid the area. Hazardous materials release, he said. Most of the time in these kinds of emergency, we don't have a clear picture yet of what's going on, but we know we have to tell people something. In the middle of a night emergencies, the desk staff often have to send out messages with permission from a sergeant or lieutenant authorized to approve Alani alerts. Every police officer in the area was jumping on top of this thing and trying to help the victims and get people out of the area. At that point, they're still sorting through what's going on. It is still an active shooter. Has he left the area? Our immediate concern is not only the safety of people in the area, but getting people information to stay safe. The Uvalde Police Department has separate Twitter and Facebook accounts where it can issue more details, although in this case, the Champaign Police Department was handling the release of information. The first at UIPD Twitter message was posted at 3:44 a.m. saying, "Police are investigating a shooting near 3rd and Green. Please avoid the area and call at Champaign PD if you have information." Now, we'll talk about that here in a second, because we now know that there were many, many, many witnesses to this, and most likely there were cell phone pictures and videos that were being taken at the time of the shooting and of the fight. So I'm going to give some information here shortly as to if you have that information, where you go with it. Please help the police and the local authorities clear this up. Getting all the information they can is very, very important. Even if they have a suspect, even if they've made an arrest, please make sure that if you have something on a video or on a cell phone or any kind of witness, if you witnessed it personally, please call the police. We'll get to that in a few minutes. Because they have separate Twitter and Facebook accounts, you can use that as well. Police Chief Jeff Christensen sent out an email to the campus with more details at 10 a.m. Sunday. Wade, who was out of town over the weekend, was on the phone at 2 a.m. with other officials as the shooting investigation unfolded and doesn't remember any purposeful decision not to include information about shooting victims. Wade agreed that it's important to get information out about injuries, but what we're saying is that we don't feel the Alani alert system is in the appropriate place for that information. Given that there were so many people in the area, a lot of people injured in the first few minutes, there were other things that took priority over telling people things that can wait until later, he said. The website says it's designed for incidents which represent an imminent threat to life, health, and to the general campus population. These messages provide emergency information and instructions. Once we start going away from that and start issuing additional information that we can say on social media or in a press release or campus safety notice, then we start to get away from the Clery Act definition of what's notification. And what started this whole thing? If I tell you a person's dead, four are shot and injured because of a spilled drink, I mean, it's flabbergasted. I'm just flabbergasted. It makes you want to just sit up and say, is that possible that a spilled drink could have triggered the shooting? A Champaign teenager paroled 2 weeks ago from boot camp for a shooting offense that had been charged with first-degree murder and aggravated battery with a firearm in the death of a bystander in the shooting early Sunday morning in Campustown. Now, what I've heard, and this allegedly, is that this is the gentleman who was paroled by Judge DeFantis at the objection of the state's attorney, Julia Reitz, or of one of her assistants, and they told Judge DeFantis, do not release this gentleman. He's not a gentleman, he's a kid. He's 18 years old. It all appears to have stemmed from a spilled drink, State's Attorney Julia Reese said of the convoluted facts that led to the savage beating of one man, the fatal shooting of a visitor to Champaign, and the wounding of three others. Authorities announced at the morning news conference, and this was this morning at 10:16 a.m., that they are looking for Robbie M. Patton, 18, whose last known address was in the 500 block of East Washington Street. Once again, I'm asking every concerned citizen out there who has any information whatsoever on the whereabouts of Robbie M. Patton or information concerning what happened on that evening. Circuit Judge Tom DeFantis on Tuesday issued a warrant for Patton's arrest with a $5 million bond, and he's accused of fatally shooting George Korchev, 22, of Mundelein, who was visiting Champaign over the weekend, was sent to begin a new job Monday as a registered nurse in Libertyville. Patton was paroled September 9th after having served an 8.5 months of an 8-year prison term for aggravated discharge of a firearm. It was DeFantis who recommended Patton for boot camp in April over the objection of Assistant State's Attorney Matt Bannock, after Patton pleaded guilty to the weapons charge for firing a handgun December 14th in the parking lot of Steak and Shake. No one was injured in that shooting. In Sunday morning's gun violence, Reed said it appears that Patton was allegedly shooting at a group of men who had beaten his friend. Reed laid out the following facts for the News Gazette. There was a party going on in the apartment at 306 and a half East Green about 12:30 a.m. Sunday. During the party inside, a girl spilled a drink on another girl. This led to a disagreement that spilled out into the parking lot. That address is a three-story building that features retail stores on the ground floor and two stories of apartments above. It has a parking lot to the west, and just west of the post office, immediately cast the structure of a high-rise apartment building. Security cameras, videos show many, many people in the parking lot and different fights going on. Apparently, the boyfriend of one of the girls in the drink altercation got involved in a fight with five or six other young men. We obtained cell phone video of the very brutal fight where he ends up unconscious on the ground. These five or six are kicking him about the head and body while he lay unconscious and nobody helps him. Reed said another piece of video showed people milling around the lot and an individual in a black sweatshirt, later identified as Patton, comes over and sees his unconscious friend. Robbie Patton gets agitated, pulls the hood of his sweatshirt up over his head, and takes off towards the north. Witnesses report seeing him holding a gun and firing it in the direction of the victims who were walking on the path and not at all involved. The intended targets, he said, were apparently the men kicking Patton's friend, but none of the four men hit by gunfire were involved in the beating. What a tragedy. The path she referred to is a walkway on the north side of Green Street, north of the apartment building where the party was, which runs alongside the Boneyard Creek. That's where Mr. Kortchaff was fatally wounded as he walked with two male friends. One of his friends was also shot but survived. Two other men in that area were also hit by gunfire and survived, according to Lieutenant Schaefer, head of the Champaign Police Department Investigations Division, which is working nonstop on the shooting since it happened. The shooting occurred just minutes after the man's beating, Reese said. She added that authorities are confident there was only one shooter on Green Street on Sunday morning. Meantime, Reed said police are still working to identify and locate the men who attacked Patton's friends. They are also expected to be criminally charged. Authorities obtained cell phone video from a woman who was recording the beating. After hearing the shots, she ran into traffic on Green Street and was hit by a vehicle but was not seriously injured. The driver of the vehicle that struck her stopped further down on Green Street and notified police about hitting the woman. This is like dominoes. One thing leads to another, to another, to another, and more people are injured or hurt. Reed says police have spoken with the beating victim who spent the night at Carl Foundation Hospital and was released. The apartment where the party was going on was rented by some Champaign residents, and despite its location in the heart of campus town, police didn't think any of the people directly involved in Sunday's melee were University of Illinois students. Schaefer said Tuesday that contrary to initial police reports, detectives didn't think the Green Street shootings are related to one that happened about 30 minutes later, several blocks to the west. Boy, it's coming in bunches. Schaefer said police did not have much information about a party on South State Street near John Street where a woman was shot about 1:08 a.m. We have not gotten a ton of cooperation. We have very limited information on that, but little we do have does not connect it to the Green Street shooting. Schaefer said, unable to theorize what may have participated the gunfire there. In the Straight Street shooting, the woman received a minor wound to the leg, he said, and was treated and released. Champaign County Street Crimes Task Force is following up on the shooting and was treated and released. The Champaign County Police Task Force is following up on that shooting. He said Patton was already arrested once this month after his release from prison. On September 11, 2 days after being granted parole, U of I police arrested him for allegedly lying about his identity. A police report said Patton was a passenger in a car that police stopped about 1:15 a.m. that Sunday near Green Street and Locust for an alleged traffic violation. Smelling cannabis emanating from the car, police said the driver, Tyron Mercier, 18, of Champaign, get out. He was later arrested and charged with possession of intent to deliver cocaine and possession of cocaine after police said they found individually wrapped packets of cocaine in his pocket. Patton was charged with misdemeanor obstruction of identification and was in jail until December 19th, where he posted bond. Prison and court records show Patton served a total of 259 days behind bars in the county jail and the state prison system for the Steak and Shake shooting. In that shooting, also investigated by Champaign police, Patton is thought to have fired a gun at two men in the parking lot of the restaurant at 5:30 p.m. on Monday. This is an habitual criminal, and he's back out on the street. Police said he and Antonio Wright were inside the restaurant when they were approached by two men and asked them to step outside. They did, and Patton retrieved a gun from a sports utility and fired at the other men. No one was hit. Well, I'll tell you, I'm sure they will. It might very well have happened by now, but I'm sure that Mr. Patton is going to be in custody shortly, but it's a little bit late. I'm sorry to say that this kind of situation is happening way too frequently here in Champaign now. I'm not sure what the answer is, but we have to make sure that the police are given all the cooperation they can. And please, please, you know, even if you call, you can be anonymous, and there might be a reward if you call in information to the tip line. So please, do me a favor. Do yourself a favor. Do the community a favor. Give a call to the local police and see if they can be of help, and you can help them to help keep our streets safe. If you'd like to make a phone call, you're listening to WEFT 90.1 FM on your radio dial. We are here in Champaign, Urbana, and we also stream live at weft.org. It's now 8:21 and 30 seconds, and the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker, and that's me. Do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, Champaign, Perrier, Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. So, 217-359-5483, if someone would like to make a phone call. We're here waiting. Now, this next story will help us, in essence, save us some money, all of us. It's called the Bogus Jury Bill Goes Down the Drain. Well, I had this to worry about when I was chairman of the county board, this unfunded mandate of, well, let me tell you the story and then you'll see what I'm talking about. Taxpayers in each of Illinois' 102 counties can breathe just a little bit easier thanks to a court decision that saves them from an unwise, unwanted, unaffordable, and unfunded state mandate. 2 years ago, a lame duck General Assembly threw a bone to the trial lawyers by reducing the size of juries to 6 members and ordering county officials to raise juries' pay. And, of course, there was no money from the state to raise juries' pay because the state is broke anyway. On Thursday, the Illinois Supreme Court unanimously overturned the legislation, holding that it violates the Illinois Constitution that guarantees citizens a 12-member jury. Taxpayers stand to save a bundle as a result. The decision stems from a Cook County civil case in which Associate Judge William Gomolinski, let's pronounce that correctly, concluded late last year that the 6-member jury edict violates Article 1, Section 13 of the 1970 Constitution. The language at issue states the right of trial by jury and therefore enjoys remain inviolate. The key phrase is there is as heretofore enjoyed, Judge Kamalinsky's first and the State High Court's second each concluded that the phrase as heretofore enjoyed included a right to a 12-member jury. This court has long interpreted the phrase to mean the right of a trial by jury as it existed under the common law as enjoyed at the time of the adoption of the respective Illinois constitutions, Chief Judge Rita Garman wrote for the court. Garman wrote at length about both the history of common law as it relates to jury size, as well as about the debate on the issue during deliberations of the 1970 state constitution based on both Garman and concluded jury size is an element of the right that has been preserved and protected. Noting that legislators' decision to increase the pay of juries went hand in hand with the decision to reduce the size of juries, Garman said the court had no choice but to declare the legislation entirely invalid. Increasing jury pay raised hackles among county officials, including myself, statewide because it dramatically increased costs without providing the funding to pay for these increased costs. On its face, the legislation appeared to be another mindless decision by ignorant legislators to force increased costs at another level of government. But as it is often the case in Illinois, the real story regarding jury size and pay was mostly hidden from public view. This bill came out of nowhere in December of 2014, passed after brief deliberation over 3 days on a party-line votes. Democrats favored the bill while Republicans opposed it. It was, in brief, another exercise of extraordinary power by Democratic House Speaker Michael Madigan. The Chicago Tribune reported at the time that the legislation was a gift to trial lawyers as a reward for past and future campaign contributions. Trial lawyer favors six-person juries because their research shows they award more generous cash judgments than a 12-member jury. Although touted publicly as a measure to reward and encourage jury participation, the legislation actually was a prime example of insider politics. Nevertheless, it raised the jury's pay to $25 for the first day and $50 for each subsequent day. At the time, Champaign County paid jurors $10 a day, Ford County $15, and Douglas County $25. Vermillion County paid $20 for the first day and $30 for each subsequent day. Given the severe budget constraints many counties face, the extra costs posed a severe burden, one now that will be lifted. The cost decision, however, does raise a vexing question. What about all those cases decided with a six-person jury? Given that the court has ruled that 12-person jury is a fundamental right, are cases decided by six-member jury now open for review? The legal system doesn't need this headache and wouldn't have if politics didn't trump policy in the General Assembly. Well, think about it. What they did was they decided to raise by five times the pay for a juror. I would love it if I was a juror. The problem is, in all of my years, and I've got a few decades behind me here, folks, I've never been called to jury duty, as my wife hasn't. So I can only tell you that one of these days I might get a letter in the mail or a postcard saying, come in for jury duty, but I don't know, the odds seem to be getting shorter and shorter as I get older and older. But $50 a day is very nice, especially if it comes out of your pocket and my pocket, because I'm paying myself pretty much. It's coming out of the taxpayers' money, and it's coming out of the county, who has very little leeway when it comes to budgeting, obviously, what's going on in the state and at the federal level. So if you have some comment about that, then give me a buzz, 217-359-5483. Otherwise, we'll move on to the next issue, which is also about the county board. And it's something that I am very, very personally against. It supported the reform that comes in the form of political self-interest. That's what I think, and so does the county board. It's an odd political year, so in that spirit, it seems perfectly appropriate to have two odd referendum questions that would affect Champaign County government on the November 8th ballot. One calls for an elected partisan county executive to preside over the county board, something like a mayor for the county, complete with veto power and staff. Guess what that'll cost? The other question, which was put on the ballot by the county board after the first proposal became public, calls for the countywide election of a board chairman. Now, that I can think about it. It's going to confuse you when you get there, okay? Vote against the executive county board chair and vote for or vote against both. Why don't we just do that? Vote against both. Because this one calls for a countywide election of a board chairman. The current system, the chairman, as I was, elected by the majority of the 22-member board, has its problems. But neither of the two alternatives promises a solution to those problems. That's why the News Gazette recommends a no vote on both measures. I, too, recommend a no vote on both measures. We'll make it easy for you not to worry about which is yes and which is no. Just vote no on both. And we can move on because you elected each of your representatives to the county board. And they represent you, and they represent your vote on the county board, 22 of them. By their vote for a chairman, they're really exercising the right that you gave them when you voted them in and elected them to the county board. And that, I think, is the way it should be. The genesis for both proposals stems from policy and political decisions. For starters, Republicans, who dominate countywide offices, believe they can win the office of county executive, a move that would put them back in the political driver's seat of the county government. Almost as important, backers of the county executive believe a strong leader at the top could push a divided board to make decisions it has been unwilling to make over the past 5 years. Among the issues left unresolved are the future of the county jail, what to do about the county nursing home, and the infrastructure improvements. But there are no guarantees for either premise. I don't want to see someone who has a lot of money, has no understanding of the political system, has no understanding of the county, has no understanding of how it works, to be elected as a new layer of bureaucracy with a staff that will cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. A GOP win is no sure thing, although odds favor that premise, but Democrats, Julia Reed, Naomi Jacobson, and Laurel Prussing, have been elected countywide before. Further, there's no guarantee the Republican who elected will be a capable, dedicated public servant as opposed to just another schmo looking for a comfortable post in county government. And what about the elected executive administrative support staff? Are taxpayers interested in bigger and more expensive county government at the time they can barely afford a county government that's already bigger than it should be? There's no question there is energy in the executive, but the mere presence of an executive will not necessarily provide sufficient impetus for a divided county board to make decisions it can't make now. Executives don't make laws by snapping their fingers. It starts in the form of a proposal that is considered by the county board. The frustration felt by the Champaign County Farm Bureau and the Champaign County Chamber of Commerce is perfectly understandable. County board deliberations do something resemble a train wreck. Sometimes that happens, but sometimes that things that can be discussed, compromised, and work forward. And we've done that a lot at the county board. Yes, there are some that are down partisan lines, which is understandable in a two-party system. But at the local level, we do certainly a lot more talking, a lot more compromising, and a lot more effort than is done at the state or federal level. That I can tell you right now from personal experience. One way to improve the situation is to make certain that in the future, county board districts are not gerrymandered to determine the election results in advance. But I'm sorry. If the Republicans can gerrymander for 150 years, I think that the Democrats can for 20 and give them a little more time. Competitive board races should produce more board members open to compromise, which there are. The grease of effective governance instead of inflexible partisan attitudes isn't always at the county level. I can tell you that from personal experience working with many Republicans and as a Democrat working with both sides of the aisle to get things done. And we have gotten things done. And I'm sorry to say that this is not that much of a partisan group other than the fact that the Dems now control it by a 12-10 margin. As far as the countywide elected board chairman goes, the plan is not foolproof either. The individual selected would have no more power than the current board chairman, although electing a chairman countywide would bring more transparency to a current secretive conspiratorial process. What are they talking about? Everything is open. The votes are open. There's no secret to the votes. Whoever votes, if you get a majority of the county board, you can be elected as the chair. There are no current secretive conspiratorial processes, I'm sorry to say. Past board chairmen have been effective because they were able to build working majorities. Thank you. The current majority Democratic board is divided among two rival Democratic factions and Republicans. Why would it suddenly become more effective if it had a countywide elected chairman as opposed to a chairman elected by a board majority? And it wouldn't. And I agree with that statement. The chairman is right now doing the job that they're supposed to be doing. And then they're overseen by the county board. That's not to say it's a bad idea, says the News Gazette. Indeed, it's a potential interesting idea that raises the possibility of a Republican chairman of a majority Democratic board. But it's not obviously a better idea than what exists now. So call us unpersuaded that a different approach would be a better approach. The county board, assisted by a non-gerrymandered map and an interest voting public, can hail itself. That's why voters, in our view, should reject both proposals to change the leadership of the county board. And I agree. It should certainly reject both. So I'm asking you, when you go to the polls, reject both of those referendum. Now comes an interesting and I think sad story. Illinois video gaming has generated $785 million. Where's that money coming from? Okay. It's coming out of your pocket, out of people who are obsessed with gambling, or obsessed with winning, but you know the odds are always against you when you gamble. I can tell you that. This $785 million, which could have gone into other areas, resources, and from the taxpayer, is now going to where? These gambling joints around town, they keep proliferating. Have you noticed? Everywhere you look, there's another woman's name or now a man's name, and come on in and spend your money and see if you can win something. It's just from Carbondale, Associated Press. Data from industry experts in the state of Illinois show video gaming has generated $785 million in state and local tax revenue since the machines were legalized 4 years ago. Southern Illinois reported that the number of establishments in Illinois that allow the machines have grown as well, with 5,600 businesses having machines. Illinois Gaming Machine Operators Association's officials said the state brings in more than $22 million a month in taxes from gaming that meant to support capital infrastructure projects. Yeah, it's meant to. Good luck. Let's see where it all goes, actually. How about paying a few bills? The association's president, Michael Jalatka, said the number indicated that the association is fulfilling its goal of supporting businesses and bringing in tax revenue for state and local governments. Our goal from the beginning with video gaming has been to make an economic difference, yeah, but not for the people that are losing their money. For our partners who draw players to their establishments, for their employees and patrons, and for our state and local governments who need tax revenue to support their services and programs. Sure, like an unfunded mandate for juries. Well, take some of that money, right? Support their services, right? Okay. Haven't they cut social services? Haven't they cut a lot of different programs? Because they have no money. So they'll use your money out of your pocket that might pay for rent, might pay for food, might pay for childcare, okay? And you can lose it and give it to the government so they can do what they want with it. Our goal from the beginning, what can I tell you? An economic difference. The numbers confirm video gaming is making the difference. We look forward to working with policymakers in Springfield and communities to build on this good part. Oh, sure, let's have a couple of hundred more of these around town. The study found that video gaming tax revenue can grow to about $500 million annually. If the about 150 municipalities that don't allow video gaming decide to participate. The study does not include the city of Chicago. According to the Association of Chicago, and included in the study, the numbers could reach $700 million a year. Yep. Oh, that's a lot of money. A lot of money that is disappearing down a rabbit hole. Okay. What can I tell you? Okay, you locals, you want to call me, somebody who's a gambler, and tell me why? It's good to have all of these gambling joints around town. 217-359-5483. Look forward to hearing from you. Hit and run investigation. Urbana police impound the stolen vehicle. Urbana police have impounded a pickup truck that they believe might have been involved in a hit and run incident in early Saturday morning. According to a police, a 43-year-old Chrisman man identified Monday as Jason S. Doggett was struck by a light-colored truck while washing the windows of the bridge that goes from Carl Clinic Annex to Carl Hospital. Doggett, who police say remained in critical condition, was standing in the roadway about 6 a.m. while a coworker provided traffic control on Western University Avenue. About 6:30 p.m. Saturday, acting on a tip about a suspicious vehicle from a resident, thank you, whoever that was, Urbana police were dispatched to a home in the 1400 block of Beach Street. A resident in the area reported that the truck had appeared to have struck something was not normally parked in the neighborhood. Upon arrival, Rutledge said officers found that the unoccupied truck had significant front-end damage consistent with the hit-and-run. They also learned that it had been stolen on September 9th from the 400 block of Urbana MacArthur Drive, Rutledge added. The vehicle was ultimately impounded for processing. Police did not enclose any details about the driver's identity. Rutledge said the investigation is ongoing. Anyone information can call Urbana Police at 217-384-2320. Callers may remain anonymous by calling Crime Stoppers. Now, you can call about this issue, or you can call about the shootings on campus on Green Street, or you can call about the other shootings or other incidents that are going on. These are anonymous tips, and you may be able to get a reward. So call Crime Stoppers at 217-373-TIPS, T-I-P-S, or CCTIP, plus the information to crimes at 274-637. Or again, Crime Stoppers, 217-373-TIPS. Thank you. The day after. Oh, by the way, update. Just came in over the wires. Let's see if we can find the update here. I know I have it. It's about Miss Laurel Prussing. I don't know where she went here. She's running again for mayor. Yes, she is. Oh, boy. I'll tell you, for her fourth term. That's interesting. I don't know what happened to it. Well, I had it here and just bounced away on me here. But we know also that there was a heated city council meeting that Aaron Ammons just really signed off on. He was pretty interested in what was going on in diversity. So we're going to be discussing that. Let me see if I can pull up this article on our lovely lady here. All right, we're getting there. Here we go. Okay. Laura Prussing throws a hat in the ring. Laura Prussing will seek a fourth term as Urbana mayor in April, she announced today. It will be a two-woman race at least between Urbana's first female mayor and city councilwoman Diane Marlin, who announced her intention to run in June. Of Marlin's candidacy, Prussing said, "That's fine, I'll run on my own record. I've been pretty innovative." And so, Miss Prussing will throw her hat in the ring one more time. And I can only tell you that she's quite a lady. She was asked how she differentiated herself from Marlin between now and April. She said, "I don't think I have to differentiate myself from Diane Marlin. I'm not going to have a vicious campaign." About the possibility of a second council member joining the race, Aaron Ammons told the News Gazette last week he's also mulling a run. Prussing said, "Anyone can run. Doesn't matter to me how many people are running." Prussing, who was elected mayor in 2005 and won election in 2009 and 2013, said she made the decision a while ago but didn't feel the time was right for a formal announcement until now. In a news conference at her home office that lasted about a half hour, Prussing also spoke about dilapidated Landmark Hotel. Her goal is to reopen the former Jumers as a boutique hotel. Crime rates that have gone down since she took office. I've been able to make tough, good decisions. Ammon's accusations that the city isn't prioritizing diversity or the issue of racial disparity in traffic by police. He's not dealing with the facts, I think, is kind of off base, which we're going to go into in just a few moments in more detail. The city's ongoing feud with Carl over property taxes. We'll never treat someone the way Carl has treated us. Her chief goal, a fourth term, to put Urbana on sustainable financial footing. Okay. So a day after a heated council meeting, Aaron Ammons sounds off on Urbana's glaring lack of diversity, just as she was talking about. Mid-morning Tuesday, on his Facebook page, Urbana City Councilman Aaron Ammons expanded on the topic that led to a heated debate the night before. Under the heading Racial Profiling in Urbana, Ammons wrote, "I have learned that even those who claim to understand the issue have implicit defense when I raise the contentious disparities. In their responses, some of us can hear blacks just drive worse than other ethnic groups. Blacks commit more crimes than other ethnic groups. The police have to be able to impede on the freedom of movement of African Americans because it keeps our streets safer." Or as Diane Wolf Marlin and Pat Connolly love to slip in their comments, "We have to stop the gun violence that's making our streets unsafe," as if racial profiling has actually changed this obvious concern. I was certainly educated to some degree last night about the difference between investigatory stops and pretextual stops during the exchange between the chief and I, something I appreciate is being educated. I have said on numerous occasions that any motion or policy change I propose in regards to traffic stops have been tempered with the caveat that if the police have had hard evidence that the person driving has committed a serious crime or is in clear and present danger to the community, then the police should be able to use every tool at their disposal to address the community concern. So the notion that I want the police to not enforce the law that is repeatedly put forth by current Urbana police chief is ridiculous. The police in every city in America has some autonomy when it comes to enforcing the law. They have the discretion to watch a law being broken and ignore it based on the severity of the violation or other mitigating circumstances. For instance, an officer can write a warning ticket instead of an actual moving violation ticket that is accompanied by a fine or a court date if they so choose. An officer sitting on the side of the road or interstate can ignore drivers who are driving 5 to 10 miles an hour over the speed limit. So again, to claim that somehow Aaron Arams is advocating for some special treatment for criminal back folks is yet another example of selected application of standards. If an officer can ignore a speeding driver, then certainly they can overlook a driver whose music is a little too loud, who has something dangling from his rearview mirror, or even so dangerous, a license plate light being out. As for ever so progressive Urbana, no one is responding to the fact that it's virtually impossible to be serious about external unfair disparate traffic stop against African-Americans and Latinas, when internally the city of Urbana is one of the least diverse places to work and serve. I've raised this issue on numerous occasions privately, was assured that the city of Urbana is committed to diversity. Yet the city has departments that have 21 people, and all of them, 18 or 19 of them, are white. When this was pointed out to them, I was told there would be work done to address the glaring lack of diversity, because it was, if not reflective of the demographics and values of the city. What happened? Two openings developed since those conversations. Who filled the vacancies? Two white people. Now, the city of Urbana can't address such a glaring lack of diversity in one of its most visible departments. How can I logically conclude that the city as a whole will ever take serious the issue of racial profiling and its impact on African-American communities? Okay. Well, that's pretty heavy. And so now we're going to have a heated race for the mayor of Urbana. And I'm thinking that Aaron Amos is going to jump in. What the heck? He certainly likes to bring controversy, and sometimes for the good and sometimes not necessarily. So let's move on to another issue. It may affect you, it may not affect you, but it certainly is a national issue that can affect you locally. Experts worry about ripples from Yahoo breach. Have you heard about that Yahoo breach? The Associated Press has something to say about it. And as investors and investigators weigh the damage of Yahoo's massive breach to the company, information security experts worry that the record-breaking haul of password data could be used to open locks all over the web. Let's see if we can find out what we can do about it. Well, it's unknown to what extent the stolen data has been or will be circulating, or how easy it would be to use if it were. Giant breaches can send ripples of insecurity across the Internet. Data breaches on the scale of Yahoo are the security equivalent of ecological disasters, said Matt Blaze, a security researcher who directs the Distributed Systems Lab at the University of Pennsylvania, in a message posted to Twitter. A big worry is a cyber criminal technique known as credible stuffing, which works by throwing leaked username password combinations at a series of websites in an effort to break in. A bit like a thief finding a ring of keys in an apartment lobby and trying each one and every door to the building. Software makes the trial and error process practically instantaneous. Credential stuffing typically succeeds between 0.1% and 2% of the time, says Schumann, Chief Technology Officer of Shape Security. That means cyber criminals wielding 500 million passwords can conceivably hijack tens of thousands of other accounts. Becomes a numbers game for them. So will the big Yahoo breach mean an explosion of smaller breaches elsewhere, like the aftershocks that follow a big quake? That seems unlikely, given that Yahoo says the vast majority of its passwords were stored in an encrypted form, believed to be difficult to unscramble. On the other hand, Yahoo said that the theft occurred in late 2014. Oh, it's only 2014, meaning that the hackers have had as many as 2 years to try to decipher the data. Oh, that's wonderful. They said he didn't see a surge in new breaches so much as a steady increase in attempts as cybercrimes replenished their stock of freshly hacked passwords. The first hint that something was wrong at Yahoo came when motherboard journalist Joseph Cox started receiving supposed samples of credential hacked from the company in early July. Several weeks later, a cybercriminal using the handle Peace came forward with 5,000 samples and the startling claim to be selling 200 million more. Wow. On August 1st, Cox published a story on the sale, but the journalist said he never established with or certainty when Peace credentials came forward. He noted that Yahoo said most of its passwords were secured with one encryption protocol. While Peace's sample used the second, neither Peace drew his sample from a minority of Yahoo data or he was dealing with a different set of data altogether. With the information available at the moment, it's more likely to be the latter, Cox said in an email Tuesday. The Associated Press had been unable to locate Peace. The darknet market where his seller has been active in the past has been inaccessible for days, partly due to cyber attacks. At the moment, it's not known who holds the passwords or whether state-sponsored actor, which Yahoo has blamed for the breach, would ever have an interest in passing its data to people like Peace. Even if the hack was a straightforward espionage operation, Gartner security analyst Aviar Litton said there wouldn't be a reason to relax. Spies can mine trivial-seeming data from apparently random citizens to tease out their real target secrets. That's how intelligence works, Litton said in a phone call. Meanwhile, Yahoo users who recycle the same password across the internet may still be at risk. While people can always change the passwords across all the sites they use, Yahoo's announcement that some security questions were compromised too means that the risk associated with the breach are likely to linger. A password can be changed, after all, but how do you reset your mother's maiden name? Well, good luck. Good luck. All right, let's move on to sports. Well, we're at WEFT, 90.1 FM on your radio dial, and we're streaming live at weft.org, and it's 8:52 p.m., on Wednesday. This is the second Wednesday of the month, and Big Al will be back in 2 weeks on the second week of Wednesday, on the fourth week on Wednesdays, and I'd love you guys to listen in on what we have going. Okay. Do the Illini, this is from Bob Asmussen, and I love Bob. I see him on Monday nights at the sports show. He's an excellent, excellent sports writer. Did the Illini make good use of their open week? Do they have a chance to beat Nebraska? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to snicker. What changes will Lovie Smith make to his lineup, if any? For the answer to these questions and anything else on your mind, check in with your longtime college football writer. Welcome back. Back to another chat. Welcome to Bob. Hope everybody has a great week, and all I did was watch football and some baseball and golf. Is everybody ready for the first presidential debate? Well, we'll see about that. Okay, Lauren. I love Lauren. He's got so much information. He was a guest here a few weeks back. The man has such information that is just extraordinary. Football on a downward slope in Illinois. Lauren. It's been on a downward cliff, not just a slope. You're familiar with the sad tale of college basketball in the state? Pathetic. Here sits a state boasting the nation's fifth largest population, outnumbering Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Michigan, and all the others in the Big Ten, in the production of talent. We think we rival Indiana as a basketball state, but when 68 teams are announced for March Madness, the state of Illinois has not produced a qualifier in the last 3 years. Only three all Illini teams in the last 9 seasons. Talk about chilly winters. Southern Illinois last advanced to a team in 2007, DePaul in 2004, and U of I Chicago in 2002. Northwestern joined Chicago State, Western Illinois, SIU Edwardsville, and never having participated. Look east and you'll see Indiana, Purdue, Notre Dame, Butler, and Valparaiso enjoying the thrill of the playoffs. Look west, Iowa State, Iowa, Northern Iowa have been participating. Now it's affecting football. Worse yet, in the in-state disease has spread to football. Call a doctor. Could this be our worst overall start to the autumn season? Northwestern came off a 10-win season to fall before Western Michigan and Illinois State on Saturday. Nebraska gave the Wildcats life with two fumbles on 1 yard line and still breezed 24-13. Illinois has been outscored 82-33 in the last two outings as Lovie Smith tries to halt the spiral ahead of Saturday's 2:30 p.m. date at Nebraska, where the Illini are 3 touchdown underdogs. Northern Illinois overachieving in the posting, a 57-13 record in 5 years, ending in 2014 as dismal 0-4. After falling 28-23 to Western Illinois. These are the Huskers who reached the Orange Bowl in 2012, defeated Iowa and Purdue in 2013, and whipped Northwestern in 2014 while riding high in the Mid-American Conference. Illinois State, which attained previously unknown heights in a 9-7 upset at Northwestern, promptly lost 3-pointers to Eastern Illinois and Indiana State, and faces the prospect of tangling with perennial FCS champion North Dakota State in Fargo on Saturday. You might say the state football prospects resemble the state's economy, bankrupt. Just to the north, Wisconsin Badgers are riding high, wading through a brutal early schedule. Michigan and Ohio State are next. They posted ground-shaking triumphs over LSU and Michigan State. Kudos to them for building a brand and establishing a culture. They attended 21 bowls in 23 years, 6 Rose Bowls, and since 2010, they are 37-12 in Big Ten play. They've earned their reputation as overachievers. How did they do it? Well, while the U of I has 3 campuses, Illinois and otherwise divided with competitive directional outposts from WIU, EIU, and SIU, all undoubtedly challenged in their quest to maintain enrollment and acceptance standards. In this state, loyalties are split a dozen ways, and particularly in greater Chicago, which is just as close to the Madison campus as to the Illini. There's no other Wisconsin football program among 128 FBS teams. All 13 four-year public schools and 13 fresh soft schools are part of the UW system. Everyone surrounding the state capital rallies around the Badger brand. They have one loyalty. Marquette, a leading private school and gave up football more than half a century ago, has just 11,500 students compared to U of I Milwaukee's 27,000, the state's largest city. The boat moves faster when there is one coxswain and everyone rows to the rhythm. Okay. School tax plan. We've got about 3 minutes. Maybe we're going to bypass that. We're going to get to that the next time. It's now 8:58, and we'll be going off the air in 2 minutes here. I just wanted to say I have really enjoyed being on this radio show and this radio station, WEFT, for more than a year now. And I have been honored to allow to be able to talk to you, to our community, to everyone who who is in earshot of this broadcast. I want to thank all of you for listening in. I look forward to seeing you for many, many more radio broadcasts here on WEFT 90.1 FM. But I know we've just finished our pledge drive, and we reached our goal. And I'm very, very elated about that, but we are still in dire need. Financially, this radio station is in trouble, and we need your help. So if you can add a few more bucks and add another donation, I would really appreciate it. We look forward to seeing you in a couple of weeks. Have a great one. Take care and stay safe. We'll be right back.
All right. Thanks, Al. You are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM and streaming online at weft.org. I'm your host for the next hour, Mara, here from 9 to 10 every other Wednesday, second and fourth Wednesdays, for Sync Sound System Volume 2, playing bass music and funky dance music to get you grooving on Wednesday evenings. All right, so today or tonight, we are going to hear a few brand new tracks, as per usual. I'll try to keep it fresh here, and actually a lot of new artists who have never played before. Some even I've just discovered somewhat recently, so I'm really pumped to get them out on the airwaves to y'all here. Just playing a few that I've played in the past, but brand new artists, all the rest of them, so stay tuned. Let's start it out with, let's do someone from Seattle. He is called Luke Mandala. Haven't played anything of his before. And he is on the Merkaba Music label. And let's hear what he's got here. This one is called Friendly Tea, which is funny. I think last show I played something having to do with tea. I think it was called More Tea. Who was that one by? More Tea. Anyway, you can go to my SoundCloud if you're looking for any of the track listings. I also upload them often in live time on the website. If you scroll down to the bottom, weft.org, you can see some of the live track listings. But yeah, let's hear More Tea by Luke Mandala. Thanks again for tuning in, and enjoy the tunes. Thank you. That was Suhan with BYOB with Azam Ali. That was just released in April. Suhan also has a pretty sweet new album that came out in February. You can check their Bandcamp page. That's soohan.bandcamp.com, called Global Gate 808. Really cool kind of world tribal feeling. A lot of remixes, funky stuff, 10-track album. Again, suhan.bandcamp.com, that last one. Before that, we heard Dirty Wolves, which is Levi Witt out of Austin, Texas, kind of outer space, mid-tempo, side-up bass music. And he also just released a new album called Ah Yes on Street Ritual, which is also Austin-based. So that just came out September, this year. So just a couple weeks ago, new album by Dirty Wolves. And you can also stream that one on his Bandcamp. Started off that set with Luke Mandala out of Seattle with Friendly Tea on Merkaba Music label, one of my favorites. And really fun start. Some new artists haven't played yet before on this show. All right, real quick PSA, World Music on WEFT is every 2 to 4 p.m. Monday through Friday, and you can hear each Airshifter's personal take on world music to the selections that they play, which means that you, the listener, get a terrific cross-section of music from around the world. WEFT's world music genre director works with the leading world music labels, as well as independent artists, to add new music to the WEFT library every month. All right, thanks for giving World Music 2 to 4 p.m. Monday through Friday a listen on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM and streaming online at weft.org. Back to the music. All right, we have coming up a couple from this new collective I just discovered over the summer, thanks to a friend of mine who I believe is listening out there. Sam, if you're listening, what's up? And Sam goes by 5 a.m. And I'm gonna play one of his songs since he is tuned in today. And Aquatic Collective also released a compilation of some great artists trying to get their names out there. Some great talent, a lot of undiscovered artists there. So you can search them on SoundCloud or Facebook and see what artists are on that collective. Here, let's play one. A new release, 5 a.m., is an excellent bass dance DJ, and I met him recently at a festival. He is out of Delaware, so East Coast bass music. Let's check it out. Here is Parting the Hole, and then we'll hear another on that collective from Owl in Clear Light called Bloody Moon. Let's check it out. Here's 5 a.m. Thanks for tuning in to WEFT. All right. Thanks again for tuning in to WEFT Champaign 90.1 and streaming online at weft.org. Let's check out what we just played here. Started out that last set with some artists on the Aquatic Collective, 5 a.m. with Parting the Hole. That's a new one out from him. Sam Andrus out of Delaware. Clear Light and Owl with Bloody Moon, also out on that compilation album with Aquatic Collective. Just recently, let's see, they are a Nordic label. I think they originally from Belgium. Just discovered them recently. Followed by Sacred Sounds remix of a Zebler and Conti Experience song called Perceptronium. And that one is self-released and recently out. Sacred Sound is out of Asheville. Andy Buns, and has some real crunchy tunes, world fusion, bass sounds, really great stuff. Doesn't have too much on the web, so if you can ever catch him live, great experience. And Zebler and Conti Experience is Zebler Studios, who is the lighting artist for Iodo, known to fame, or claim to fame that way, but he also is a producer, and yeah, so Zebler and Conti Experience has their own thing going on. But anyway, that was Perceptronium. And then we heard Land Switcher, which is kind of a new artist that I've discovered these past few months this summer here. And that song we heard was Root Fraction on Rhythm Code 2, which is a compilation album out this year from Shanti Planti Records, which is a great collective. Check out some of the other artists if you enjoyed that last tune off of that label. If you're looking for any of the track listings, you can go to the weft.org website and scroll down to the bottom, and you can see I've been posting those in live time. You can also check out my SoundCloud page. None of these are posted up yet, but I have some playlists up there. You can look up Mara Ironstone and check out some of those playlists if you're looking for more similar tunes. All right, coming up next, we have a few I've never played yet, so let's see what's up on the list. We've got Eurythmy. Let's check this one out. This one is called Primordial. Yeah, I've heard of Eurythmy the past couple of years. I don't know if I've actually played anything, so let's hear this one. And yeah, hope you have all been enjoying. Thanks again for tuning in. I know that some of you are listening from faraway places, so I super appreciate it. And yeah, every other Wednesday you can tune in. On the other alternating Wednesdays, 8 to 10 p.m., Adrian has his own sync sound system, flair of other electronic tunes. So every Wednesday you can hear some dance music here at the station. All right, without further ado, here's Eurythmy. Check it out. We'll be right back. Bird divination right there. We have time for one more. Again, you can go to the weft.org website and scroll down for the track listing from tonight. Before that last one we heard, which was Of the Trees, Mekanos, and Of the Trees, I believe, is from Maine. And that was from his Dream Atlas album, which is a new album off of Shanti Planti Records. You can check out that album on his Bandcamp. Again, that was Of the Trees. Before that, we heard Eurythmy, who's from the UK, also off of Shanti Planti Records. I guess I'm picking a bunch of those tonight. And that was Primordial off of his Nature of Mind album, which is also a new album. And you can check that album on Bandcamp, 7-track album that came out August 9th of this month. A lot of new music coming out in this bass realm. All right, I have time for a little bit of one more. Thanks again for tuning in to Sync Sound System Volume 2. I'm your host, Mara, every other Wednesday. This last tune, let's hear Atiya with Sixth Circuit, which is on the Clear Path compilation album from the Desert Dwellers album. All right, let's hear this one, and then I'm heading it off to Barb with Not Quite Over the Edge. All right, thanks again for tuning in. Appreciate it so much. Have a great evening.